He has been elected a fellow of the British Academy, and he has served as a past president of the British Society for the Philosophy of Science. He's very widely published, numerous edited books as well, and today he'll be speaking to us on the topic of equivalence and emergence within dualities in physics. Please join me in welcoming Professor Butterfield.
Well, thank you very much, Alyssa, and also to Karen for great opportunity to be here. It's really an enormous pleasure and a great honor to be in this wonderful historical distinguished series here in BU. So this talk will be a little different from the other two in several ways. One is I'll talk quite a bit about when two theories are equivalent and not much about emergence. The emergence will come in at the end. The other thing is that it is rather low tech in terms of physics compared with the previous talks, but there's more logic, as the word equivalence might suggest. And I will be teasing our logician colleagues who may or may not be present. So I will try to stop soon enough to get flack, substantial aggro from the logic gang. Right. Anyway, so what am I going to do? I have had the great pleasure over the last few years to work with Sebastian de Haro, who gave the first talk, in thinking about dualities. It's been a great opportunity for me to learn from him. And he wrote down, and I endorsed, and we've written a more developed discussion, but he wrote down an account of what a duality is between two theories. And therefore, I want to first say what that notion of duality is and then relate it to when are two theories the same. So there's this account of dualities, and I'm going to relate it to equivalence of theories and then to when one theory emerges from another. And what is this account? We're going to call it a schema. It's actually a very logically weak definition of what duality is. There is a kind of growing literature on dualities in physics amongst philosophers of physics, and the suggestion is some kind of giant symmetry from one theory to another. Rather than just a symmetry that takes a state to another state, you have a symmetry that takes a theory into another theory so that they utterly match. So you'd like to call them the same, but are they really the same? And of course, physics and everyday language are very opportunistic and flexible about how to use words like same and equivalent. And one of the sad but true facts about this apparent kindred spirits and friendly neighborhood atmosphere we have between physics and philosophy is that over in philosophy, as logicians know, we get hammered into our heads to not be opportunistic and flexible, but to be rigorous and pedestrian and logic chopping. And therefore, actually, we wouldn't call them the same, even though physicists call them the same. We wouldn't call them equivalent, even though physicists call them. So there's a kind of problem of calibrating the different spirits and reflexes and gut reactions of the different languages and the two communities. Anyway, so that'll be clear in this kind of middle part of the talk. The notion of duality that we articulate takes it logically weak idea. You have two theories that share a common core. This common core should not be thought of as obtained by quotienting, especially. But it is itself a theory, and we actually think of it as like representation theory. You have an abstract group, you can have a matrix representation of it in 3x3 complex matrices. You can have a representation of the same group in 7x7 complex matrices. These representations might not be faithful. They're a homomorphic copy of the abstract group, and they are in general not isomorphic to one another. But we say duality is like the case of having two isomorphic copies of the abstract group. And of course, these homomorphs of the abstract group, one might be 3x3 matrices and the other might be 7x7 matrices. But as a homomorphic copy of the abstract group, they are isomorphic. that's duality, right? The 3x3-ness compared with the 7x7-ness is like the disparate appearance of the two dual theories, which will be labeled with the mnemonic labels 1 and 2, or rather, better, left and right, okay? So we'll have duality maps going across the page. At the end of the talk, we'll have emergence maps going up the page, okay, which will be exactly Sebastian's link in his talk. So that's what we say duality is. And about equivalence, I'm going to make a main remark, which is pretty obvious actually, that dual theories can disagree, that they don't have to, in the sense of logic and philosophy, be equivalent. And there are two ways to disagree. One is we're talking about the same subject, but we contradict one another. The two things we each say cannot both be true. Contra for contradiction. And there's another way to disagree in a wide umbrella sense of disagree. This is not ordinary English or even ordinary American. May I make so bold as to cheese you all? You can disagree in the wide sense of simply saying different things. I say the sky is blue, you say grass is green. Different subject matters. Our assertions are in fact compatible. They can both be true, but in a sense we've said different things. Okay, so that's diff. And of course, in duality, when we're going to have a case of diff, there's a sense in which the subject matters on the two sides are sort of isomorphic, but they are different subject matters. And there are examples both of contra and of diff among dual theories. This remark is pretty obvious. It has one merit, that if you look at the recent literature amongst philosophers and logicians about when are two theories equivalent, there has been an emphasis on saying, oh, logical equivalence, which comes from the logic books, is too strong, and we need to weaken it. Well, I'm going to have this remark will give us a salutary lesson in the opposite direction, right? Weakenings of logical equivalence will be worthy in what these authors are trying to do, but they will not be in any way solving the puzzle presented by the remark. Okay, and then in the third part of the talk, I'm going to endorse De Haro's account of emergence from the first talk today, and I'm going to set it in the context of dualities, and in fact there's a sense in which we're going to put it beside dualities. Okay, so that's the aim. So actually there are six sections. I'll talk about dualities in a general way. Then there will be a formal farrago of the type that you have come to hate in overly logic-chopping philosophy class, where there are many angle brackets but no real mathematics. Right? that's going to happen in section two. And then there's going to be a polemical description of what it is to do semantics. And then there's going to be my undeniable remark. Then there's going to be my undeniable implication. And then there's going to be my undeniable treatment, I trust, treatment of emergence, which is a bit controversial, of course. Okay, so here's how Seb and I use the words. The common core we call a bear theory, and it can be modeled, well, it can be realized or formulated or instantiated in various ways, but we will use the word modeled. And this is like representation theory, as I said with the example of a group. And these instantiations or realizations or models are in general not isomorphic with regard to the structure they represent, but they might be. And when they are, we say we have a duality. So we're going to call these two dual theories model triples. And the reason we say triple is, as in Sebastian's notation, not every theory is best presented like this, but many theories are best presented as a state space, a collection of quantities, and a dynamics, curly S, curly Q, curly D. Okay. So we'll often, throughout this talk, we'll have theories treated as a set of states, a set of quantities. It's a phase space or a Hilbert space. It's an algebra of quantities. real valued functions on a classical manifold of phase space or linear operators on a Hilbert space, and there'll be dynamics. But it is a low-tech talk. None of the details of these theories will be needed, really. So in any case, we call the dual theories model triples, right? And the important thing here is that when you've got the kind of upstairs common corners and the downstairs variety, and you've got two words that are endemic in both physics and philosophy, namely theory and model, you have and you always think of theories as more general, more abstract, or in some way covering all cases, whereas models are specific or less general. You have a question when you have two dual theories, which are now the downstairs, how on earth are you going to use the words theory and model? Are you going to say they're theories and upstairs is super theory and get rid of the word model? Or are you going to jack the word theory up a level and talk about bare theory upstairs, and what you called your two dual theories are now called models of the upstairs theory? We adopt the latter, okay? Theory, common, upstairs, models, the two dual theories are now called models. Therefore, our word model does not have the connotations that it normally has in the philosophy of science, right? It does not mean a specific solution for a physical system. It's a whole darn theory. It does not mean an approximation, and it is not part of the empirical world, like a scale model of a hydroelectric dam. The other thing is that I've obviously said it's logically weak, and I've already presented the idea, and I didn't say anything about the scientific importance of dualities or why they're interesting or surprising. But yes, we admit, of course, there are these crucial aspects to duality that makes them worth studying. You normally discover them in the context of studying not a bare theory and looking at its representations, but you and your colleagues are looking at two different interpreted theories and are then amazed to discover that they are isomorphic representations of some common core structure. Okay, so the other thing we have to just admit outright is our notion is very logically weak, and all kinds of trivial examples will instantiate it, like two matrix representations of an abstract group. And nobody would write home to say, my goodness, I found two isomorphic representations of an abstract group. So that they, you know, that's not scientifically important. And of course, there are things you can say about why dualities are often in physics linking weak coupling regimes on the one side to strong coupling regimes on the other and so on. But none of that high-tech physics will really come up in this talk. Okay, so there is this is the notation which I warned you about, the kind of angle bracket mania. We're going to have a model M, that's privately that for you, that's a theory, but M for model. And we're going to have a notation about how it augments the structure of the theory T, which it's a homomorphic copy of, with some specific structure, call it M bar of its own. So in the matrix case, choosing the complexes as a ground field and choosing the matrices to be 3x3, that is specific structure. It is building blocks. It's ingredients to cooking the meal. With that, you build the homomorphic copy. So the ingredients are still in the cooked dish and the building blocks are still in the house when you finished it. So yes, the curly S, curly Q, curly D, which is the homomorphic copy of the bare theory upstairs, it's got the ingredients and the building blocks in it. But conceptually, in your mind, you should separate them out. There's the homomorphic copy, and there's what's specific. Okay, so we'll write little m for the homomorphic copy. It's the model root. It's the bit that's the representation. Typically, throughout this talk, it is, in fact, a triple. So little m is the model root or model triple, and then there's big M over bar, which is the building blocks with which you built this thing. So the schema for duality is to say that it is an isomorphism of model triples, meaning with respect to the structure upstairs, And that's why they're called model triples. I mean, writing curly S, curly Q, curly D with a subscript M means the model's states, the model's quantities, the model's dynamics. And they're a homomorphic copy. There could be loss of information of the bare theory upstairs. But this homomorphic copy is built with what you might call local Lego, right? It's got its own specific, only in this formulation, building blocks or ingredients with which you built this copy. And a duality between two such model triples is an isomorphism of their state spaces. And it's an isomorphism of the quantities. Okay, so we're going to write D for duality and little s for state and little q for quantity. And so there's this match across the two state spaces such that the values match. Now here the angle brackets mean a different thing. They mean the value of a quantity on a given state. This is this kind of thing you get often in these structural studies of physical theories, whether quantum or classical, of the pairing between quantities and states. Each one defines a real number function, real valued function on the space of the others. So that's the pairing that gives a state. So there's this values matching, fine. Furthermore, there's what in math you'd call equivariance. The dynamics on the two sides meshes, and in the Schrödinger picture of dynamics in which it is the states that change over time, you see it on the bottom left. There's on the left, in the model triple number one, there is a map that between noon and 12:05, states go into their time evolutes. It's the downward pull of D for dynamics, subscript S for Schrödinger, 1 on the left. And on the right, there's a dynamics in the other model triple. And the duality map on states needs to respect that dynamics. If you decided to do dynamics in Heisenberg picture, in which it's the quantities that change, then you would have the diagram on the bottom right. But like almost everybody, I tend to think in terms of Schrödinger evolution. I know I shouldn't in any context, but you know, such is life. It's a natural way to think. So that's the schema for duality, very logically weak. Okay, so this is the teasing slide. The great Frege, the great Carnap, and then the great Lewis and Montague in the 60s developing it, thought of a way of doing semantics in which, especially with Carnap and Lewis, you pay a lot of respect to issues of modality, of possibility and necessity. And using the Carnap jargon, words and sentences' meanings are, this is the crucial thing that Cambridge hero Bertrand Russell always failed to get into his head, and told by my teacher that it's because he never wrote notes on what he read. He read Frege, but he never wrote notes on it. So he read that absolutely mind-blowing paper on sense and reference, but he never really accepted the notion of reference, and therefore the notion of sense. He always had a two-column theory of language and the world. Language on the one hand, references on the other. Therefore, ho-ho, you know, as it might be, Sebastian de Haro, proper name, okay. That's a proper name, human being, no problem. But what about the King of France? Yikes, no King of France. Oh, and wild goose chase for the logically proper name, which is in some way guaranteed to have a reference that underpins how language comes onto the world. But Frege had already solved the problem, really. The words the King of France have a sense, but they lack a bearer. Big deal. Linguistic meaning is mostly sense, which is the mode of presentation of the referent, and it is the route to the worldly referent that the human mind, through language, uses. Right? He even calls it mode of presentation of the reference in the great sense and reference paper. So anyway, Carnap says, let's call sense intention, and let's call reference extension. And let's say that a predicate has its set of instances as its extension, and of course its linguistic meaning as its intention. And let's allow for contingency, modality, possibility, and necessity by saying that we have a space of possible worlds, and at any world, a predicate such as is walking at noon on Friday the 19th of October 2018, that predicate will have a certain set of instances who all those people who were walking at that time. And it could have been different. Maybe, you know, a billion people are walking, but it could have been only 100,000 people. So the set of instances will vary from world to world. So the intention, which is the linguistic meaning, can be presented as a map which assigns to each world the set of instances at that world. So the intention is a map from worlds to extensions at that world. This is an extremely smooth and suggestive way of thinking about the semantics of natural language. And as I write in the second paragraph, it has the great framework of respecting the meaning of words, as I just did with my example of walking at noon on such and such a day. And you will say, but come on, Butterfield, respecting the meanings of words is exactly what semantics is meant to do. If you're to call yourself a semanticist, you better respect the meanings of words and spell it out. So don't make such a fanfare of the fact that you're doing so. But actually, as you know, when you first struggle with logic, the semantics in books of logic and model theory don't respect the meanings of words. In fact, sadly, they don't ever have a real word to which you assign a meaning in the book. They have a capital F, open brackets, close brackets, for a one-place predicate. And they have a capital G, you know, open bracket, comma, close bracket, for a two-place predicate. And then you consider the mathematical consequences of assigning all possible references to these formal predicates. All of which is highly important and totally wonderful and, of course, changed the face of philosophy forever. But it's not what you'd call the semantics of a natural or scientific language. Okay. So, what's good about intentional semantics is also that it gives us a nice rendition of an intuitive idea of topic or subject matter. Namely, so if you take something like the subject matter, I'll take, as I indicated, I am a great fan of David Lewis, who writes like a dream, apart from his other great inventive brilliance. And he takes a good example, 17th century Netherlands. Is a subject matter. People can be an expert in it. And he says, so the natural rendition of a subject matter that you first think of is something like part of the cosmos. It's a bit of spatio-temporal geography. It's a region of space-time about which there are facts. But then you think, actually, there are other subject matters, like how many stars there are, which are not naturally associated with a given region of space-time. Or Queen Victoria's taste in clothing. It's not naturally associated with a region of space-time, but it's a subject matter. So there is a generalization which you can useful to adopt. The space of possible worlds has ever so many partitions. Equivalence relations can be defined on the space of worlds, and the cells of the partition are the equivalence classes. And if you say something like, how many stars there are is my subject matter, what you're introducing is a partition on the space of worlds in which worlds are counted as equivalent. They are in the same cell of the partition if they exactly match on that subject matter. But they may differ arbitrarily on other topics. So it's a very coarse subject matter. It doesn't tell you much about the world to only know how many stars there are. Even more Queen Victoria's taste in clothing. And in this way, obviously, you can talk about one subject matter being a part of another. The subject matter 17th century Netherlands is obviously part of the subject matter, the history of the Netherlands. And that is because the partition of all possible worlds corresponding to the history of the Netherlands is a refinement of the partition corresponding to the 17th century history of the Netherlands. The idea will be for the history of the Netherlands that any two worlds exactly match in the matter of the history of the Netherlands will be in the same cell. But the history of UK and USA could be totally different between them. Right? Okay, so this is the idea. In any cell of the partition, any two worlds match as regards the subject matter. And a proposition will be entirely about a subject matter if the set of ways it can be true is exactly a union of the cells of some of that subject matter. Okay, so now we can talk about how two dual theories can disagree, either by contra or by diff. We don't need all our philosophy of science, philosophy of physics discussion now. This is just pure elementary logic class. It's Venn diagrams. In fact, I drew the Venn diagrams in green for you. Contra is a case where there is one subject matter about which there is a mutual contradiction. For example, the color of the sky is the subject matter. On the left, somebody says, it's blue. On the right, somebody says, it's green or red. They cannot both be right, is the idea. Contradictory assertions about the same subject matter. And that's true, called contra. I drew vertical columns to indicate the cells of the partition. There's the kind of top left to bottom right shading, and there's the bottom left to top right shading. They're two different propositions. They don't overlap. One proposition is a union of two cells. The other proposition is logically stronger. It's only one cell, right? So it's you might think the sole cell one is saying the sky is exactly what we in England call royal blue. I don't know whether you're allowed to call it that. Thank you, Professor Lloyd. I'm so relieved.
My school of colours.
I'm delighted to. I'm obviously on a bit of a teasing mood here, and it's inspired by my dear friend Seth Lloyd, who always refers to me when I'm in an audience of his talks, because we know each other these many years. So I am going to focus my royal blue teasing on my transatlantic kindred spirit, Seth. Thank you. I'm glad you call it that, Seth. Okay.
Watch out, Seth. You saw notorious royal blue.
Okay. So anyway, somebody could say the sky is blue, and the other person could say the sky is either green or red, and so it would be logically weaker. Right. On the other hand, you could disagree in that umbrella sense of simply saying different propositions, which could in fact both be true, because your subject matters are different. Somebody says there are a zillion stars, the other person says Queen Victoria had a terrible taste in clothing. These could both be true, right? And this is on the other side, where you see the horizontal banding is one partition, the vertical banding is another partition, there's an overlap in the different shadings. Okay. So what's the remark? Okay, there are going to be now at last some down-home physics examples. Here's the remark about how dual theories can disagree. Here's an example of contra. I want you to consider Newtonian mechanics with absolute rest, or rather two formulations of Newtonian mechanics with contradictory specifications of what is the absolute rest. So let the bare theory be Newtonian mechanics as it is often now thought about in senior year and beyond, namely that there is no absolute rest, and we call it a Galilean space-time or a neo-Newtonian space-time, and there is a notion of absolute acceleration but not of absolute velocity or absolute rest. And in the beyond senior year, so to speak, you will learn the words affine connection, flat affine connection, as specifying this absolute acceleration structure. So I want you to imagine, so to speak, Alice on the left, Bob on the right, to adopt the colloquialisms of, after all, we're in the photonic center. Alice on the left and Bob on the right will be advocates of different specifications of rest. They are back in the time of Newton and Leibniz. They have not done modern differential geometry and realized what, I think it was Cartan who first realized that you could write down Newtonian theory in space-time context with exactly this kind of flat affine connection but no absolute rest. And you're to think of them as sadly rivalry between them, right? I mean, they have disagreements. Bob firmly believes that absolute rest is given by a congruence of parallel, straight, inertial, time-like lines, which is boosted with respect to what Alice believes. Right. Okay, well, one can write that down as a duality in the R sense. And at this point, it is very tempting to say, because we're all sophisticated moderns, but these contrary specifications of absolute rest, they are gauge. They are a distinction without a difference. They are a sign that we are in a very bad intellectual situation, and we must move to a neo-Newtonian formulation in which this surplus structure of absolute rest is eliminated. And of course, the critique of Newton, this is one of the sadder parts of the heroes of logical positivism, the critique of Newton as a dogmatic absolutist, because he had an unverifiable postulation of absolute rest. This is, part of this first paragraph polemic, right? And it is indeed tempting to say these things, and you might think the elimination of that kind of idling cog, as Wittgenstein once put it, or spinning wheel, or freely movable parameter in a theory that makes no observable difference what its value is. It is a source of intellectual suspicion. But these are the insights of hindsight, or temptations of hindsight. We now know what to do. Go back to 1710, then be a Newton or a Clark, then the duality illustrates contra, right? But I do agree, these temptations do hint at the role of dualities in our seeking, given that we're just given these disparate looking and yet strikingly isomorphic theories, looking to formulate the common core above, which we may not have got hold of, right? And even we might say, I'm not interested in moving to a common core of which they are representations in a pretty rigorous sense. I want to allow a looser relationship of approximation in which beyond the common core, there's something of which they are some kind of limiting regime or approximation. Okay, here's my second example. Position momentum duality in elementary quantum mechanics. Well, this is called duality, and it will be an example of diff, okay? And actually, we have to do a little bit of fancy footwork to make this an example of diff, because as normally discussed, and rightly so, it is not an example of disagreement of any type, not even in my weak sense of diff. So anyway, we'll begin. We're going to say it as it's normally said, and then we're going to do a little tweak to make it become an example of diff. So I want the Bayer theory to have as its state space the wave functions. And the quantities can be the linear operators on the wave functions, written there in notation. Now, the idea would be something like the left dual is about position and the right dual is about momentum. And your quantum mechanics book teaches you that these are really choices of basis in a Hilbert space. And what the book says more formally is a wave function, and I've written it in elementary terms as literally a complex valued function on the real line, so I've got a spinless quantum particle in a single spatial dimension. Well, that wave function is mapped by a unitary map F for Fourier transform, right, to its Fourier transform psi tilde, and this maps the representations of position and momentum as operators, and your book tells you how this is a change of basis, and indeed inner products are preserved under a change of basis. They can be evaluated in different bases, and this is not an example of disagreement. This is an example of just different coordinates in Hilbert space or in the state space, and in fact, therefore, this is a very good prototype for the general idea of dual theories in which there is full agreement. It's as if you have scaffolded the degrees of freedom of the system you're concerned with in two disparate ways, right? And in fact, in Seb's and my main paper so far, we go through bosonization as a deep and recent complicated example of exactly that, right? Redescription in a radically different way, as a fermionic quantum field theory or as a bosonic quantum field theory of one and the same conformal field theory. And it's in fact, again, with a unitary equivalence. But I can twiddle this in a completely silly philosopher's way to turn it into a diff. And I'm gonna do that by saying, I will be like Niels Bohr. I will say I can only think about position or about momentum. I cannot combine the two. There are two perspectives that cannot be adopted together. So I want Alice on the left to be a position monomaniac. She only wants to talk about position. And on Bob on the right, only about momentum. So when you hand Alice a psi, she immediately takes mod psi squared and says, this is the probability distribution for position. And she's willing to consider functions of position as other quantities, f of q. And she does her physics, and she'll even have the Schrodinger equation involving the psi, and she'll always ruthlessly mod squared and say this is the probability density function for how position evolves, position probability evolves. Over on the right, Bob is a momentum maniac. And the duality map, actually, is then the identity map on states, but now with a reinterpretation. The same complex-valued function psi is mapped over to, by the identity map, to that same complex-valued function. It's just it'll be given a different interpretation on the two sides. So these are different subject matters. There's a system, this spinless one quantum particle confined to a single spatial dimension. Alice has got position spectacles on. Her subject matter is position. She only discusses position. She makes a certain assertion. The mean of position is blah. Over on the right, Bob says the mean of momentum is blah, the very same. After all, as it's a function that is the identity map. So it's a different assertion. They could both be true. Think of a coherent state. Mean of position equals mean of momentum. Variance of position equals variance of momentum. Okay, so I also had Kraner's Vanier duality in classical statistical mechanics in the 2D Ising lattice, but let me skip over that. What's the implication of this remark that dual theories can disagree either contra or diff? Well, I'll do this quickly. The implication is that obviously two dual theories might get of this type, might get formalized so as to be logically equivalent in the meaning of the logic textbook. So you have to imagine Alice and Bob are speaking, they are advocating their theories, and they either are a case of contra or they're a case of diff. And a ardent formalizing logician has come in to write down their natural language scientific talk as a formal language and write down their doctrines as an axiomatic theory. It is possible, in such a case as we're now confronting, that they will be formalized so as to be logically equivalent. They could use the same words and thus end up speaking the very same sentences, but they mean different things by those words, and they will be rendered logically equivalent by this ardent formalizing logician who does not ask what their intended meanings is. And obviously these duals are not equivalent, as equivalent is normally understood in everyday life. So logical equivalence will be too weak to explicate theoretical equivalence. And therefore any weakening of logical equivalence will be too weak. And this is worth stressing because the recent philosophical literature about the equivalence of theories has focused on logical equivalence being too strong, right? Because logical equivalence of theories requires that they be cast in the very same vocabulary. Like I was joking about the predicates F bracket bracket or G bracket comma bracket. It has to be the very same vocabulary for the logic and model theory book to say these are logically equivalent. This means that when Maxwell says Maxwell's equations, hopefully in a more modern notation, thank you, Gibbs, Heaviside, Hertz, for rendering this comprehensible. And then Poincaré, 200 miles south, says it en français. Gosh, it can't be the same theory according to a logic or model theory book because the vocabularies are different. And for that reason, synonymy is a problem. And the literature says we must liberate ourselves and get weaker than logical equivalence. But what I'm talking about is homonymy, i.e. the same word with different meanings, not two words with the same meaning. That's what happens in cases like we're concerned with. So, okay, I did have Alice. This Alice Bob joke was conceived before I knew it was called photonic center. It's in the slide, right? If Alice and Bob are unwise enough to use the same words in their advocacies, and if an appropriate subset of their words have a kind of inverted meanings, appropriately inverted, then what they say might be the very same, the words they come out with could be the same, even though their theories disagree. In which case, this odd and formalizing logician listening to them both will render them as logically equivalent. So as it happens, this slide does talk about Alice on the left. She's very interested in a low temperature lattice, and she speaks standard English, and she uses the word low temperature like we do. And she says her theory of the low temperature lattice. Over on the right, Bob, that duality is a low temperature, high temperature flip. Over on the right, Bob is studying a high temperature lattice. Unfortunately, his vocabulary is low, high, inverted in its meanings compared with Alice. And so when she says low temperature to mean low temperature, he sadly says low temperature to mean what you and I call high temperature. Or this is the example we actually had. Alice on the left speaks standard English. She says position, she means position, like you and I. Over on the right, Bob sadly says the word position, but means momentum. The odd and formalizing logician will write them down as being logically equivalent. It's a case of homonymy, even though they disagree. Okay, so this implication has certain ramifications for the literature about loosening the notion of theoretical equivalence, and these recent authors preoccupied by these matters. Let's turn to emergence finally. The last section now, emergence beside dualities. Well, de Haro's talk, entirely true. We are going to take ontological emergence as Little Roman 1 and Little Roman 2. It is a relationship between theories. It is given by a linkage map from the bottom theory TB to the top theory. It's written as link. It's in general many to one. It's like a coarse graining map. And the domains of interpretation D are different. D for domain now, not for dynamics, okay? We won't see the D of dynamics again. It's just always D for domain. And therefore, the setup is like you have on the brown picture on the left. At the bottom, the setup for mingling Sebastian's framework with duality is as in the diagram, which is the brown picture on the whiteboard. So I wish to envisage two theories on the left and the right at the bottom level, B for bottom, but there are also two theories at the top level, T for top, and there is a link map whereby the top may or may not emerge. In order for there to be emergence, you would have to have distinct domains of interpretation of the type that Little Roman 2, novelty of reference, like Norton and de Haro were saying. So this picture is drawn as commuting, but I'm not saying that it always commutes. I'm saying this is the topic that we investigate now, this square. Does it commute? What are the maps? Give me an example. If I've got this link map, would it be an example of Little Roman 2 and I would claim emergence? Well, what we're going to see actually is illustrations of this square, and we're going to put our examples, our trivial examples of Newtonian mechanics and position momentum duality at the top, and we'll put them at the bottom. And it's really totally elementary, but it's worth spelling out, since everything is on, all the bits to say the doctrine are now on the table. So here's the contra Newtonian mechanics case revisited. Let's put them at the top. Take the two formulations with their rival specifications of rest at the top of the diagram. Okay, so top of the brown diagram. On the left, Alice. This is my specification of what is absolute rest. Top right of the diagram, Bob. Oh no, Alice. Real rest is boosted with respect to you. Downstairs on the bottom, imagine non-relativistic quantum theory, set in Newtonian space-time with rival absolute rests. They are dual by a boost map on quantum states and quantities. It is the exact analog of the boost map we have upstairs that was essentially 10 slides ago. It's the analog downstairs on the bottom as it is on the top, because the boost business between these 1710 style theorists about space-time, the boost business is completely regardless of whether you're talking quantum or classical. Right? It's the same boost physics, whether for point particle Newtonian gravity or non-relativistic quantum theory. So Link will now be, and this is where the can of worms, the elephant in the room, the scandal of physics is suddenly on the table here, and it came up in Karen's talk, the quantum measurement problem. There is rival accounts of how the classical emerges from the quantum. Let's use as a label H bar goes to zero, to whatever that means. There's this Link map. Most would say that it's going to count as emergence, even ontological emergence. Certainly, whether it is emergence doesn't depend upon a boost. Right? It's not going to be emergence for Alice, but not emergence for Bob. It's manifestly, these are orthogonal areas of human inquiry or subject matters or something. So there's ontological emergence, almost all of us would say. But in any case, the diagram is illustrated. Right? We can also put the Newtonian mechanics example on the bottom if we wanted to. I'll do this more briefly. So let them now be what you might think of as the micro detailed theory, of which there will then be a coarse graining. So put our Alice and her Bob as originally discussed, with their Newtonian mechanics, point particles under gravity in a Newtonian space-time, let them be on the left and the right, on the bottom row. And now just imagine collective variables such as the center of mass, or the center of mass and a few other collective variables that you could define. That is very much a many-to-one situation in which many different configurations and velocities of all the capital N point particles will give rise to the same values of the collective variables. And there can be a boost map up at this level of the coarse grained variables. And we've got a commuting square. Most would say that this Link map wouldn't really give ontological emergence. This is just collective variables, coarse graining, the summarizing of a complicated system by a few relevant collective variables. Okay. But anyway, in both cases, whether it's at the top or at the bottom, we do have contra, right? Going back to our previous discussion of equivalence. Okay, well, I will stop, but I would just say position-momentum duality, it's the same game. We can put position-momentum duality, monomaniac Alice on the left at the top, monomaniac momentum Bob on the top, on the right. We want something from which this emerges. As dear Alyssa knows from our late and much revered friend and hero Jim Cushing, advocate of the pilot wave theory, there is in the on the shelves a noble tradition of underpinning orthodox quantum theory with a more detailed micro story, the pilot wave. And so let that be the pair of bottom theories. But with the wrinkle now that, and the pilot wave theory will be happier on the left with position being emphasized, but there'll be this wrinkle that there's a kind of position monomaniac Alice pilot wave theorist in the bottom left of the Brown diagram, and there's a momentum maniac Bob pilot wave theorist on the right of that diagram. Okay, and so it goes. And one can put them at the bottom and talk in the same way, and thank you very much. And here is some.
The physicist Sabine Hossenfelder, in her book Lost in Math, has a criticism of your use of tuples for defining logical theories. Her argument is that for it to make sense, the theories have to be like real numbers, sequences, least upper bounds, discontinuity, and that's not empirical, or at least requires experiments to fill in the details. That would be her criticism.
Who's criticism?
Her name is Hossenfelder. The book is Lost in Math. She's a physicist.
Yes.
So do you understand? Her criticism? What I'm trying to explain her criticism. You need mechanism. You need least upper bound. You need order relations. You need all of that. And your theory, and that is a problem for your theory from the viewpoint of a physicist.
I like and admire the book as I do her other work.
What little I know of it, her advanced physics, I don't know, but she's always, you know, polemical but very defensible, sensible in her views. The book, in case you don't know it, called Lost in Math, now out, says something like how the search for beauty has led physics astray. And the idea is we're stuck in physics because we're searching for the beautiful. And she talks about, for example, supersymmetry and how beautiful it is, but hard to see. So I won't try to summarize the book, but I would say that my one-liner reply would be that she's absolutely right that we should be open-minded to find dirty, ugly, detailed, concrete, not beautiful. But actually, when data is few and far between, this is another one of her points that she's emphasizing, that data in fundamental physics is few and far between now. When data is few and far between, actually you grab whatever heuristics you can, and simplicity or beauty inevitably draws one in. So at the level of asking questions, I find it hard to endorse her skepticism about beauty. But at the level of solutions, I agree she's got a very good point. We shouldn't expect the simple and the beautiful to work out.
She has a specific argument against the tuple definition of theorists, and it is that it needs the mechanism of real numbers. That's what I was hoping
okay.
to react
to. Okay, well, I actually, this goes into a long and open-ended discussion. I would reply, I have not, I'm afraid, picked this up from my reading most of the book, but not all of it. I would reply something, I am a mathematical Platonist. I believe in an abstract realm of pure mathematics, about which, by some good fortune that we, as to quote in another context, we neither know, deserve, nor understand. We have access to this realm, and I know some small fragment of the truths of that realm. And therefore, although actually perhaps the world is atomistic in a kind of perhaps causal set type way, Sorkin and co-workers, I think it's perfectly reasonable, if we are mathematical Platonists, to appeal to the real numbers to discuss and even to formulate theories. Yeah.
So let's go back to duality. So one duality that I understand is the projective geometry, the point and line. And the second one is the duality of the wave particle duality, which resolves itself into Schrodinger versus Heisenberg. And then they were proved to be mathematically equivalent, and it ended up with Dirac giving you the abstract theory. So how did these dualities play into your model of
Thank you. It's a very helpful question. Very gentle question. So I would say the first thing to say about the projective geometry, and I should have said this at the beginning, I apologize. In pure maths, whether it's projective geometry or turning intersection into union in Boolean algebra, duality is typically self-inverse map. Right, it's something you do it twice, you get back to the same. But in physics, duality isn't like that. It just is isomorphism. Well, we say it's isomorphism, but I was heartened when I've talked to physicists, and they've some have even just said, "Well, duality is isomorphism," without knowing anything about our proposal. They said they've made that contrast between the pure math. But it is true that the 1920s quantum mechanics. There are several things to say, which was your second example. I would distinguish the position momentum Fourier transform, which I took, from the general wave mechanics contrasted with matrix mechanics. But you're absolutely right about, of course, the kind of Schrodinger sketch of the equivalence, and then the Dirac consolidation, and the democracy of bases in Hilbert space that then
was clear to everybody already in whatever, 27, 28, and then of course von Neumann in 32, making it very rigorous. So what we say in print, Sebastian and I, is of course, this is a simple case where we've taken a specific Fourier transform as one particular unitary map on L2 of R in this my notation. And well, there are uncountably many unitary transformations, and they will be able to be construable in our logically weak notion of duality as dualities. And it is true in physics, as you will perhaps no doubt know, that people talk about the duality group. And the idea is, although this whole presentation has had just Alice and Bob left and right, two things, there's normally a whole orbit of things that you can get to on the right, having come over from the left. And hence there's the duality group moving you around amongst these different isomorphs. And of course, well, that's the unitary group in the quantum wave mechanics and case. So I hope that's a bit of an answer.
Yeah. You were mentioned, Haim's question was delicate. Let me ask you the less delicate version of it. A lot of what goes on in physics about dualities has to do with interactions, right? And it starts with the electric magnetic duality and then goes to, you know, all its version of it, until Malvicino's conjecture and these holographic dualities, the CFD, ABS, stuff, and all of those that actually end up being back to the Pluckert duality, because there are dualities between volumes and surfaces that bind them and stuff of the sort. I don't feel that they fit this pattern that you're trying to sort of enforce or to generalize. What is your opinion on that?
My opinion is that without it being a virtue, that it is a corollary of the logical weakness of our schema, that these high-tech and in string theory actually mostly conjectural examples would be examples, and I admit this was just a self-denying ordinance in this presentation, not least because I am ignorant of the string theory. I am truly fortunate that Sebastian wrote the doctorate on ADS-CFT and many papers about it since, therefore I am guided by him in believing that gauge gravity dualities will be conjectural, admittedly conjectural examples of, and T and S duality would be conjectural examples of the same schema. Sebastian, can I lure the lion from his den, as we say? Seth, do you say that anymore?
I think you said it perfectly. Do you have anything else to add?
No, are you sure?
I mean, well, I can give an example of how it might work in ADS-CFT. Of course, ADS-CFT is conjectural, it's not proven, but when people look at observables or quantities in ADS-CFT, they look asymptotically, the asymptotic symmetry algebra. And so our idea is that, at least in the infrared of the CFT, both the bulk and the boundary are representations, different representations of a conformal algebra defined at infinity. And so in that sense, it would it would for a physical schema. Of course, there's much to be worked out because, the details, especially the quantum details, are not fully understood.
There's another question in the back.
I sort of follow up. I don't know if it's like right on that line, but I was thinking about the holographic thing too. And the question I have is sort of just: do you think that whenever you have a duality, that's a sign that we have a further theory to go that's going to sort of somehow be the upstairs theory that resolves, or could it be the case that what we end up with, whatever that means, that we sit happily with a duality that's not like a sign of incompleteness or like, yeah. Couldn't it maybe just be that the duality is an interesting step thing? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lovely question to me as a straight pure philosopher, you would have guessed, I've got into this philosophy of physics, but I'm by background a philosopher. So I believe that it could just be that the cosmos contains isomorphic subject matters, that we are lucky enough to get a theory of each of them, and we notice the isomorphism. And but the more striking it is, the more disparate and yet isomorphic the two sides, the more it seems, you know, a heuristic that is attractive and also perhaps historically there are precedents for, to say there must be something behind it. Yeah. So, but I think your hunch that one could just have a contingent mirroring or, you know, isomorphism of two different subject matters without, I mean, nature could be like that.
this is one of the, this addresses the question as well, one of the most important relationships between duality and emergence is sociological. We take the example of string theory and idiocy of T, you know. Idiocy of T correspondence is often described as one of the string theory miracles, which in the absence of a theory that you actually have nailed down, its purpose is to inspire the faithful into believing that you're on the right track of looking at some aspect of some greater thing that's out there and you have not yet discovered.
Yes. Well, this skeptical note is very salutary.
If you're a physicist, you have to be motivated by something. The notion that you're on the right track is an important thing for struggling away in the direction.
Well, on that note, thank you.